Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have a great show for you today. I am excited to welcome back Dr. Phil Carullo, who you will recognize as having been on the show before a few times to talk about really exciting things such as tape. And today we are going to talk about a really interesting topic that I think will really be great, especially for those thinking about anesthesiology as a field, those who maybe are about to start anesthesiology, to really think about what is it that an anesthesiologist does. And we're going to get really into that, and I think it'll be a great show. So Phil, thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you, Jed. It's always a lot of fun to be here on ACRAC, you know, listening to it as a resident and a fellow and now as an attending. It's just really, really fun to have this opportunity. So thanks. And as you mentioned, I am a pediatric anesthesiologist here. I'm also the program director for the fellowship. I mostly do pediatric anesthesia, pediatric liver transplants, and peds regional. And so I have a diverse practice, and we'll often have requests from undergrads and medical students to come and shadow to see what it's like to do what it is that we do. And I found myself forming relationships with these trainees that are interested. They come, you know, a couple times over a few month period. And what I found myself doing is realizing that I'm providing a really broad overview of what it is that we do in a way that I actually didn't think about when I was a trainee. And I think some of this, if you want to call it framing or wisdom about our specialty and how we fit into the periop setting, it has evolved as an attending. And so I think it's helpful perspective for people that have both a medical and non-medical background to just understand what it is that we do. And then also I think it's great for junior residents as well, starting off on their, you know, their anesthesia residency. So this really morphed, conversation was really developed from multiple conversations and multiple people shadowing over time. So I hope that it provides a broad overview of what we do as anesthesiologists and how the perioperative domain is designed to function.
Awesome. So I think this will just be great. I wish I had had something like this when I was a medical student and I was just trying to figure out. We hear so often, right? People will say things like, what exactly does an anesthesiologist do, right? Like, you know, I know you're there. I know you put people to sleep. I mean, even patients, right, will often say to us, like, what do you do? I mean, you put me to sleep and then what? Of course, we know that what we do is very broad. And so it'll be, I think, great for people to be able to access that. All right. So why don't we start with just kind of an overview of the general expertise of an anesthesiologist? I mean, how do you answer the question, what do we do?
So just to kind of tie back to your question, when you had a patient who has had multiple surgeries, the funny thing is that they know what an anesthesiologist does, and they actually will say, I know you're the most important person in the room. So it's kind of funny because the average person having their first surgery is just like, what do you guys do? And then the people that are, you know, repeat patients, they know exactly what we do and they come to appreciate it. But your point is well taken. What is it that we do? And I kind of boil it down to three main skills that we have expertise in. One is that we place patients into medically induced comas. That's the anesthesia component to what we do. And the depth of anesthesia that we provide is really a spectrum, and it's dynamic. And as you increase through the planes of anesthesia or the depth of anesthesia, you have changes in the degree of your consciousness and also have increased risk of changes to your vital signs that require intervention. So on one end of the spectrum, when we talk about anesthesia depth, you have local anesthesia, which we all have some exposure to. You have been to the dentist and they administer numbing medicine around the nerve that goes to your tooth. And then you don't really feel them working, but you're fully conscious and your vital signs are totally stable on their own. On the other end, you have general anesthesia, which really requires an anesthesiologist. But at that point, you're fully unconscious and there's a really high risk of physiologic derangement. And so that requires you to be monitored in the operating room by a qualified provider like an anesthesiologist. And that is the highest risk of what we do. There are other anesthesia types that we provide. It's not just local or general anesthesia. We have things we can do depending on the patient population or different types of surgeries. So you'll hear the terms regional anesthesia or neuraxial anesthesia. And those really rely on the use of numbing medicines to either be deposited around nerve bundles that go to like an extremity, for example, in orthopedic surgery, or local anesthesia or numbing medicine that goes around the central nervous system, like the spinal cord. If you think about laboring women, they often get epidurals, and that helps numb the pain of delivering. So there's a range of what we do, and it's really the mastering the administration of anesthesia medications is something that we learn, but is also an art form and a unique aspect to what we do. So you'll see many providers in the ED or the ICU that they give anesthesia or sedation, but I think anesthesiologists have the most intimate relationship with anesthesia drugs.
Yeah, and I think that's the part that probably most people are most familiar with. Maybe not all the subparts like neuraxial, but just like the idea of putting people to sleep, right? That's what most people would say an anesthesiologist does. My kids, I bet, if you ask my six-year-old, what does daddy do? I think she would say he puts people to sleep, right? That's the kind of basic understanding. So very important, but there are other aspects, right? So what else do you think falls under that? What do we do?
So the other thing that the second thing that we've kind of mastered is managing human physiology and manipulating it to meet the needs of different surgical procedures. And so you could take a couple different surgeries to illustrate this well. You have a patient having heart surgery. You have your surgeon and your anesthesiologist and other providers in the room, but you are manipulating physiology to the point where you're stopping the heart. And then when the surgeon is done repairing the vessel or the valve, you're restarting the heart. And you're doing that with a combination of chemical and electrical support. And we also do things like liver transplants, where you take an organ that's responsible for managing the acid-base status of the body or the glucose control in the body, and you're taking it out for hours at a time. And you have to support the body in the way that those organs typically would while the surgery is taking place. And so we have a really intimate understanding of physiology in general, but specifically cardiopulmonary physiology. And we learn how to integrate vital signs, physical exam findings, lab data that we can sometimes get in seconds, and observing what's happening in the surgical field. And we put all this together and we make critical decisions in patient care. The other thing that we all do is we have a series of equations that we keep in our back mind, basic physiology equations that you may have learned even in undergraduate studies in physiology that help us with understanding what we can and cannot manipulate. So for example, you know, when I think about a patient who has low blood pressure, I think about the equation for blood pressure, which is cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. And then I break it down even more. So I say blood pressure is related to the heart rate and the stroke volume. The stroke volume is related to the preload, afterload, and contractility. And the vascular resistance is a function of viscosity and the resistance in the vessel. And so I laid out five or six variables that I know I can completely control depending on the circumstance. So when I see a derangement in physiology, I think, is it due to the heart rate? Is it due to the vascular tone? Is it due to the viscosity in the blood? And then I know ways that I can support the body. So we're experts in that, and we're experts at, you know, managing the physiology and manipulating it for the surgical procedures.
Yeah. And
do you have any
that
equations?
The equations are awesome, right? I mean, I remember learning the alveolar gas equation and the various, right? You mentioned the cardiac, the blood pressure, what actually blood pressure is. We think a lot about cardiac output in the ICU. And so, you know, these things are really, I think, very interesting. And we actually see them. It's one thing to learn them in the classroom, right? Where it's kind of like someone puts it up on the board and it's this abstract thing. But one of the really neat things about anesthesiology is we actually kind of do the equations, right? We're doing them and seeing them come to life in real physiology and real patients in the OR. It's why I think that one of the coolest first rotations for a med student, even if you're not interested in anesthesiology, is to do anesthesiology, because you see all that stuff you just learned in the classroom, you see it come to life. And that's a really cool thing to see.
Yeah, it's really great. And the one thing that we kind of, it should be self-evident, but may not be if you're not in this world, is that to manipulate the physiology, we're using the strongest drugs in the hospital. So we use all of the we have access at our fingertips to all the blood pressure medications to help manipulate these things. So you get to become an expert in understanding what you should use, how you should dose it, and those kind of things. And one of the things that kind of came over time for me is you get so comfortable with, you know, you know, managing physiology, and you do that, a lot of times the patients are under a blue drape, and you can't really see them the way that you, you know, look at a normal person, but you start to develop a relationship with that person's physiology on a monitor. So you have a vital sign monitor and a ventilator, and you have all these numbers, and it becomes a very intimate thing where you can stare at it and kind of understand what's going on in the body. Is there inner peace or turbulence? Is there physiologic derangement, or is it calm? And that's something that you can see the more you do this. And you can also look at our electronic charts, because they map all the physiology signs out. And so it's pretty cool. You can tell a story by looking at the monitors and looking at the chart and the patient's physiology.
Absolutely. How about the procedural side of things? I think a lot of people, medical students at least, who are thinking about anesthesiology, they think of it as a field where you do a fair amount of hands-on stuff, which I think is true. So how do we fit that in?
So that is what I think is the last thing, the third main thing that we're experts in. So we need to be able to put patients into comas, and we need to be able to manage and manipulate physiology. So in order to do those things, you have to be able to do the procedures that let you accomplish those goals. So you have to be skilled at a variety of procedures. One is airway management across the spectrum. So as you go deeper and deeper under anesthesia, the muscles in your mouth and throat start to relax and you obstruct, and that affects your ability to provide oxygen to tissues and remove the CO2 that they generate. And so you have to be comfortable supporting that patient's oxygen and ventilation levels. And so it can be as simple as putting a mask on the face and squeezing a bag and ventilating them, or it can be as advanced as placing a breathing tube. And even with placing a breathing tube, there are degrees of difficulty depending on what the situation requires of you. You can place a breathing tube with a blade. You can place it with a video-based blade. You can even use a fiber optic scope. You can do it awake or asleep. So airway management is one of those things that's critical, that we are absolute experts in, that saves lives and is a requirement for our field. We're also really skilled at vascular access, so placing peripheral IV in the arm or in the hand, placing arterial line catheters. These are basically like IVs that go into the arteries that measure blood pressure every second. Central line, so big IVs that go in the neck that we can use to administer really strong blood pressure medications. And then there are all sorts of other advanced types of IVs and lines that we can use for vascular access. We are also experts in nerve blocks, which we kind of hinted at it's basically a combination of procedures that use ultrasound or nerve stimulation devices to help you find nerve bundles. And you can administer numbing medicine around those nerves that helps you kind of block pain for certain types of procedures. The other thing that is really unique to our specialty, and actually when you look at physician specialties across the spectrum, I think we're one of the only ones that has these built-in like traditional nursing skills. So, you know, starting an IV and dressing it and hanging a medication and drawing up a medication and knowing how to label it, how to document it. Those are critical things to being safe in the operating room, but not a skill set that really other physician specialties have. It's also one of the things that makes you feel accomplished at the end of the day, that you're physically, you know, interacting with a patient, you're hands-on with them. And so there are a lot of traditional nursing skills that I think make you a really good doctor in anesthesia. And then there are emerging skills that are just, you know, constantly evolving, like the use of ultrasound to, you know, look at the heart in real time or the lungs in real time, or to check the stomach and if there's food in there. So these are skills that we're constantly, you know, innovating in our specialty. And so it's really the combination of placing patients into medically induced comas, managing their physiology, and being skilled at procedures that let you do those things. I think that's, to a large extent, what it is that we do.
Yeah. And, you know, I often think in terms of procedures, it's not like being a surgeon where you are, you know, spending hours doing one specific kind of, you know, detailed dissection of a piece of anatomy and et cetera. It's really the procedures we use, just like you said, whether that's using the ultrasound to place a line, whether it's looking at the heart function with the ultrasound, whether that's through the chest or in the esophagus, whether it's, you know, doing a nerve block. These are all kind of quick, high-yield procedures that are in service of the greater goal of providing safe, effective patient care or for surgery or pain relief or whatever it may be, evaluation of a sick patient in the ICU, et cetera. So it's a much more kind of fast-paced, short, high-yield procedures, which may or may not be, you know, your preferred way of doing procedures, right? So you may love the idea of being a neurosurgeon and spending 12 hours doing a craniotomy, and that would be very different than being an anesthesiologist and doing, you know, several kind of high yield quick procedures in a given situation. Great. So let's talk about how the care you provide kind of looks like over time. So when you are a resident, what does that look like? When you, what is your kind of experience like each day? And then how does that change when you graduate residency or training if you do a fellowship?
Great. So anesthesia residency is 4 years, and then all of our fellowships are basically one additional year. And anesthesia residency, it's 4 years, but there's like a 1 year that's like intern year, and then there are three clinical anesthesia years. So when you lump it together, it's four. And when you're applying into anesthesia residency, you can either do all 4 years at one place, or you can do an intern year at one place and then your anesthesia residency at another program. And then there are a couple of fellowships that you can do. The common ones are pediatric anesthesia, cardiac, acute or chronic pain, in critical care medicine. And as a resident, you're going to get exposure to all of these subspecialties. And one of the things that I just like to remind residents that, you know, you'll get exposure and you may like everything, you may only like certain things, but if there's a component or a practice that you saw that you absolutely want to always have the option to do, like let's say you love taking care of cardiac patients or pediatric patients, if there's a patient population you absolutely love, then that's a reason to do fellowship. Otherwise, a lot of people are just going out of residency and getting a job right away.
Awesome.
When you're and in, then, go ahead.
Go ahead, Phil.
I was going to say, but your training looks very different than when you're an attending. As a trainee, you get assigned to a room, and then you look up your patients the night before, and you call your attending who supervises you, and you say, hey, I'm taking care of so-and-so for this surgery. You give a history. You talk about your plan for the pre-op, intra-op, and post-op management. But then your day-to-day is really learning how to do intraoperative anesthesia, because there's a lot there to learn, and it's a very steep learning curve. But you have backup, your anesthesiologist, you know, supervising you, but they may have an additional room running simultaneously. So after you graduate, your practice kind of expands in a few different ways. The first thing that changes is that you are more involved in the pre-op and post-op care. I don't think I learned how to take care of a patient with post-op nausea and vomiting until I was an attending, because if it was ever an issue as a resident, I was stuck in a room taking care of a patient, didn't really see what it looked like or learn how to manage it. And you may be running more than one room. You may be running up to four rooms, depending on what cases you're doing and who you're working with in the operating room. So if you're working with CRNAs, you may be running four rooms. If you're working with trainees, you'll be running usually a max of two rooms. And for really, really large cases, you may be working with just one room and one provider. But this is not a general, it's not a hard, fast rule. So you may also be practicing hands-on like you are right now as a trainee or as you did as a trainee. But so much of how you practice, whether you're on your own doing cases or supervising, depends a lot on your specific region, state, or your institution and their practices. So as you are going through training and maybe as an early attending, you may find that you really have a preference for a certain way of practicing anesthesia. And if that's what you want out of your career, you can totally have that. You just may need to prioritize that when you're looking for a job in the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's one of the really neat things about anesthesiology is that there's just so many ways to take it in terms of specialty to practice in terms of group private practice versus academics, and even within that, what it looks like doing your own cases versus supervising residents or CRNAs or whatever it may be, AAs. So, you know, there's really something for everyone, I think. So let's talk more about kind of after training. You know, we always say your education does not stop just because you no longer are a trainee. So what continues to happen in terms of skill development after training?
So like we talked about, those three skills that we're experts in, that's what you learn in your training and you continue to develop throughout your career. But then there are these additional skills that you really don't have the opportunity to develop until you're done with your training, because for most of us, our roles kind of branch beyond the intraoperative portion of a patient's care. So with supervision in particular, you go from being in a room by yourself doing however many cases were in that room, maybe 4 cases a day. Okay, great. But if you're supervising 2 rooms or 3 rooms or 4 rooms, you could be doing double or triple or quadruple the number of cases in a day, which means you're putting, you know, 3 or 4 times the amount of patients to sleep. You're waking up those patients. And so you're going to see, you're going to make decisions faster, and you're going to see success, and you're going to see failures at a higher rate than you did when you were training because of the pure volume of cases you're doing. And there's a steep learning curve there, but it's also really fascinating. Also, because you may want to try, maybe you read an article about using, Zofran to prevent the burning of propofol. And you're like, oh, I read this, I'm going to try it. You can try it 15 times in the first week and make a decision quickly. Whereas if you're a trainee, you kind of have to ask your attending, they have to be on board. Maybe you can only do it once or twice. So you can kind of, the opportunity for you to learn and grow is greater. And supervising gives you that opportunity to make changes quickly to your practice. You also develop a broader appreciation for kind of the different pathways that a patient can take in the perioperative setting. And you're thinking in a different way. So I use the example, like when I was training at Pitt and we would get these crazy level 1 traumas, someone was shot, they would bring them in. And as a resident, I'm like, all right, I'm going to put my vascular access in, I'm going to resuscitate. And that's all I'm thinking about. And that's my focus, and it should be. But as the attending, I'm thinking, okay, great. This case is going, can I expect other casualties? If so, am I going to have to run a second room? Who will my staff be? Do I need an ICU bed for this patient? Well, we're bleeding quite a bit. Maybe I should activate massive transfusion protocol. And so I'm very focused on the intra-op care, but simultaneously I'm thinking about the whole picture and the whole spectrum. And it's really hard to do that as the resident or trainee because you're so compartmentalized in what it is that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So we also think about, kind of anesthesiologists having a broader role in the perioperative domain, not just in the operating room, but really in the preoperative area, the intraoperative area, postoperatively. So let's talk a little bit about that. How do you think about that kind of perioperative domain?
Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right. And we're back.
I think it's really helpful to, and this is slightly painful, but it's important to imagine just and understand how a patient goes from having a medical problem to ending up in the recovery room of your surgical center or your hospital. And what it does is it shows you just how much energy and investment is involved in this process. And it helps you identify the people that are critical, the team players that are critical to help you take care of someone. So imagine, you're a patient and you have this bump in your groin and you think it's a hernia, but you're not sure. So you go to your primary care doctor and they're like, oh yeah, that looks like a hernia. I'm going to refer you to the surgical office that I recommend patients to. You make an appointment to see the surgeon. The surgeon sees you. They say, yep, that's a hernia. You need to get that repaired. We're going to call you and schedule you for a surgery that fits with your schedule. Okay. Then the family or the patient schedules surgery for a certain date. And they'll get phone calls to prepare them saying, oh, you're having surgery tomorrow. Don't have anything to eat after midnight, that kind of thing. And then the patient ends up kind of showing up the morning of surgery, the day of surgery to the hospital. Behind the scenes, right, in the operating rooms itself, you have operating room staff and anesthesia staff that are being basically assigned to different rooms. So they're saying, oh, okay, tomorrow we have 50 cases in the operating room and we have 10 rooms and Dr. So-and-so, who's doing a bunch of, general surgery, one of which is this person's hernia repair, is going to be in room 1, and Dr. So-and-so is going to be the anesthesia team, and this is the nursing team. And so there's a lot of that stuff happening behind the scenes, and it usually kind of finalizes that schedule the day before. So now that patient's here the morning of surgery, they get registered, they get assigned a pre-op room, and then they end up going to pre-op holding area. When they arrive to the holding area, you have a pre-op nurse that says hi, that does a quick interview, a brief history, measures some vital signs. And then at that point, the patient will meet the anesthesiologist usually for the first time. The anesthesiologist will introduce themselves, conduct an H&P, history and physical exam, and then develop an anesthetic plan and talk to the patient about it. The surgeon will come by at some point and just update their note from their clinic visit. And then finally, the nurse in the operating room, the OR nurse, comes out and ask the patient some questions, and then verify that all the consents are complete and that all the equipment needed for the surgery are in the operating room. And then the patient finally makes their way to the operating room. They fall asleep with anesthesia, surgery takes place, and then they wake up. Now, after surgery, they can go several different places to recover. They either go to our post-anesthesia care unit, that's the PACU, and from there they can go home if it's a same-day surgery, or they can be admitted to a hospital bed afterwards, or they can go to the ICU. Those are the typical pathways for recovery. And then eventually the patient will be discharged from the hospital, and then they'll follow up with the surgeon at a post-op visit. So that is a huge amount of information, but it just shows you the complexity involved with a patient getting a surgery. And in a moment, we'll kind of dissect that out and talk about the different key players there, so that at the end of this talk, hopefully you can imagine, you know, how this all fits together.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. Obviously, I'm part of this every day, and yet just hearing you go through it, I'm struck by how many little pieces there are in just a given little surgery, let alone a big major one. All right, well, let's go through some of what those moving parts look like.
So for each of those steps, there are providers that are involved in supporting the patient through this process. But the operating room in particular is a very complex system and very expensive part of the hospital. There are a variety of studies that quote, you know, $35 to $50 a minute is what it costs to have a patient in the perioperative setting. And so when you look at kind of what administrators try to do with hospital budgets is they want the ORs to be a very efficient place. And so nursing, surgical, and anesthesia leadership, they're always trying to find ways to make this process faster, more efficient, not only to save money, but to get more patients through safely through an operation. But some critical points to highlight is that almost all of the healthcare workers that we work with in this periop setting, they are specialized nurses and technicians. And there are actually two types of physicians that work in this space: surgeons of different subspecialties, and then anesthesiologists. And as we kind of highlighted above, surgeons, they come and go. They have clinic, they have to see patients, recruit them, see them in post-op visits, they round on them in the hospitals. They sometimes work at multiple facilities. Whereas anesthesiologists, we basically live in this domain, and we're probably the most constant and familiar face to these specialized nurses and techs that we work with. And so we have a lot of influence in the periop setting, and that is one of the ways that we show our leadership when it comes to managing OR resources, managing crises and things like that. So we are the primary acute care physician in this space. We are the first line for emergencies, and this is our home. So I'm hoping that I'm driving the point that we have a huge impact on the efficiency by forming relationships, facilitating communication, and coordinating resources. So I just want to give one example here, and then maybe, Jed, I don't know if you have examples of this too, but I work in, you know, the pediatric anesthesiologist, and sometimes a child may have a disorder that is best cared for by an adult surgeon. And so an adult surgeon may be coming as a guest to the pediatric operating room. They don't know any of the people there. They have no idea how the system works. They may not even be able to get the equipment that they typically use. And so if I'm working with an adult surgeon, I'll reach out to them the day before or the morning of and say, hey, I'm the pediatric, you know, anesthesia attending. I'm here to work with you. I realize this may not be your normal environment. Tell me the things that you need, and then let me tell you the things that you're probably going to need to know to be successful tomorrow. And that really saves time when it comes to delay and that surgeon feeling frustrated and flustered in the new environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see the same thing when we have a surgeon maybe who's used to operating in a different surgery center, but they have a sicker patient maybe. So now they're going to come into the hospital to do it. And they're not used to that. And they aren't sure how things run there. And again, we're there every day, as you said. So we can really be a link to help people new to that environment to feel comfortable and to have things go as smoothly as possible.
So now we're going to finish this section basically by talking a little bit about the our partners when caring for patients. And we're going to kind of go into each of the different domains. So we'll start in the pre-op, and the main staff that you're going to work with in the pre-op are pre-op nurses and nursing techs. And when we'll talk about what they do during this phase, but it's very documentation heavy. It's a very busy time. If you look at some of these pre-op nurses that are using electronic medical records, they're just clicking up a storm. I mean, they click for like 10 or 15 minutes at a time because they have to get their patients registered for surgery, and their medical records need to be associated with the surgical encounter that they're about to take part in. They have to have a basic assessment, vital signs recorded, their MPO status verified. They have to get IV access. And if anesthesia or the surgical team ordered any medications to be given in pre-op, they have to give those medications as well. To be a pre-op nurse, you have to have a nursing background. And then there's a general requirement that you have to have worked in as a floor nurse for at least 2 years so that you have a comfort level with things like charting and basic, you know, procedures like IV access and getting vital signs and managing complex situations. So the other thing that's unique about these pre-op nurses is that the pre-op and PACU nursing staff are a lot of times the same. So they'll float. Maybe they'll do pre-op one day in the week, and then the rest of the time they'll do recovery room work, but they can flex and flow in between the two domains. The nursing techs in the pre-op area may be more skilled at IV access than in other areas of the hospital, because as part of their job description, it's very common for them to do things like place IV. So, you know, on the ped side, for example, our tech is probably better than, you know, a handful of our attendings, because they're doing IVs in kids all day long. And they're really good at it. They're at least better, maybe anatomically, whereas we're better with, you know, advanced techniques like ultrasound.
Yeah, for
the,
sure.
The recovery room nurses, the recovery room area is staffed again by recovery room nurses and nursing techs. The recovery room nurse is they operate with a little bit higher acuity, so you need more experience and comfort. So not all pre-op nurses will work in the recovery room, but a lot of them do. And a lot of the recovery room nurses are kind of early retired ICU nurses. So they worked in the ICU for 10 years. Maybe they're feeling a little burnt out or they want to switch the scenery. So they come to work in the recovery room, where it's a good balance of high acuity, chaos, but yet not so hard on, I think, the body or mentally on them for long periods of time. So in this phase, they have to be able to manage a lot of different tasks. So you have patients waking up from anesthesia. The nurses need to comfort them, reorient them. You're just waking up from surgery. And then they need to manage a lot of the anesthesia-related side effects that happen. So confusion, headaches, itchiness, muscle aches, nausea, vomiting, shivering, the sore throat from our breathing devices. And they also need to observe the surgical wound that the patient experienced. Is there bleeding? Is the wound, you know, dehiscing? Are they in an enormous amount of pain, more than I'm used to? And they have to manage pain of all severity types. So they are very busy. And then once all that stuff calms down, they have to, you know, frequently update the chart vital signs. They need to educate patients on discharge paperwork and things to look out for. So it's a very busy time for them. And one of the things that I like to do as an anesthesiologist working for them and appreciating this is that when I drop a patient off to the recovery room, I really don't want there to be anything else that the nurse has to do for that patient in terms of like pain control or nausea control. I want to give everything that I could possibly give to that patient so that they hopefully wake up feeling comfortable and the nurse is kind of like offloaded with some of that work. At the same time, I kind of mentioned it's higher acuity, you know, less common, but scary things can happen in the recovery room. Patients can develop airway problems. They can have issues with their heart rate or rhythm. They can be over-sedated, things like that. The nursing techs in the recovery phase may be more skilled at identifying airway obstruction than the pre-op nursing techs because they're there watching or monitoring. And at least in the pediatric recovery room, if you bring a patient out with an oral airway under anesthesia, a nursing tech has to be there at bedside watching until that patient wakes up. And then these nursing techs also serve as like patient transporters. So they'll take patients to different areas of the hospital and or take them out to their car after surgery.
Yeah. And I'll just say, Phil, that as you mentioned, PACU nurses often have ICU training, certainly are
supposed to be able to and can operate at that level of taking care of critically ill patients. And so we, in COVID, this was actually a huge source of help that we had our PACU nurses staffing these new, you know, pop-up ICUs. And that was a huge help at a time we really needed it.
Yeah, it's the more I think about the different players in the perioperative space, I have a lot of respect for the recovery room nurses, because, you know, if they need to get a hold of the orthopedic surgeons, they have to figure out how to page orthopedic surgeons. If they have a question about pain, they have to, you know, get a med, give it, and reach out. And so they're very good at multitasking.
Yeah.
So the last group of people we'll talk about are just the people that we work in the OR with. And the main staff in this area, the operating room nurses, the surgical and anesthesia techs, and then briefly we'll talk a little about CRNAs and anesthesia assistants. So the OR nurse has a couple different names, but it's basically the same job. So you'll hear the OR nurse referred to as the circulating nurse, the surgical nurse. Sometimes they wear sterile attire and assist the surgeon, so they call them scrub nurses. But basically what they do is they manage the overall care in the operating room, and they maintain a safe and comfortable environment for everyone in there. So before the patient comes back, they're verifying the consents, that the patient understands what they're having done. They are updating families throughout the surgery to let them know that the case is proceeding without complication. They coordinate with the pre-op and the recovery rooms. Hey, this patient's ready to come back, or this patient will be in recovery room soon. We're on our way out. And they also maintain sterile environment during the case. So I think when I was a med student, I was really scared of the circulator nurse, because I was scared, like, you know, I had a sterile gloves on and a gown, and I'd be scared I'd touch something or put my hands too low, and that the circulating nurse would see me and be like, hey, you can't do that. Then I would like be like, oh God, okay, I'm so sorry. So they are kind of the gatekeepers to the operating room. They're constantly observing, making sure that the surgeon, the anesthesiologist have everything they need to be successful. To be a circulating nurse, you need to have an RN degree. And then it's preferred, but not really required, that you have a perioperative nurse certification.
And Phil, I'll just say that the circulating nurse and the scrub nurse are different, right? I mean, the nurses who are circulating nurses can also do shifts as a scrub nurse. But in an operating room, at least almost all the time, in my experience, there are both. So you have a circulating nurse and a scrub nurse. Sometimes the person in the scrub role is not a nurse. They're a tech, in which case they are a scrub tech. They cannot be a circulating nurse. So you can have nurses can do both roles. Scrub techs just do the scrub role.
Exactly. Which is the next provider that we're working with. This is a specialized surgical technician called a surgical tech, or you may also hear them referred to as scrub tech. And their job, like you mentioned, you know, an OR nurse can perform many of their duties, but the sort of surgical technician, their job is very defined. They basically are always in the operating room. They gather, count, and arrange equipment and surgical tools that the surgeon needs for a surgery. During the surgery, they maintain the OR field as a sterile one. They assist the surgeon by passing them tools and instruments. They can also aid the surgeon in retracting tissue. They can hold cameras that are being used during surgery. They assist the surgeon in those ways. They also, after the surgery is done, they count all the instruments that were used to make sure that nothing was left behind inside the patient, that everything was accounted for. They apply dressing to the wounds. They dispose of all the sharp things like the needles and the scalpels that were used. And then the other thing they do is that even after everything's done and the patient's getting ready to wake up, they maintain that sterile environment. God forbid the patient, there's an emergency and they have to go back into surgery, that sterile field is ready to be redeployed to the patient. And so they maintain that sterile field until the patient leaves the operating room. To be a surgical tech, they have to complete usually a 1 to 2 year course to get a certificate. But this course is kind of offered at community colleges and vocational schools. And a lot of hospitals also have their own programs that they'll try to put people through. The last providers are really anesthesia providers, anesthesia techs. So unlike surgical techs, the techs that help the surgeons, the anesthesia techs kind of just float around. They oversee multiple rooms. They're not going to be by your side the whole time like a surgical tech would be for a surgeon. And their goals are really to like help and clean, help clean and maintain anesthesia-related devices. They prepare medications and equipment for anesthesiologists to use. Their education is really all over the place. Some places just require a high school degree and then on-the-job experience, and then some have multi-year anesthesia tech programs that you can participate in. I think your responsibility and your pay changes dramatically based off of which kind of pathway you went down. And then finally, our other anesthesia colleagues that we work with in the operating room. So there are nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants. The nurse anesthetists, also known as DRNAs, they're specialized nurses. They worked in the ICU for at least a few years, and then they complete an additional 2 to 4 years of anesthesia school. And then depending on the state that they work in, they can either practice independently, but more commonly they practice under supervision or in collaboration with a physician anesthesiologist. And a lot of kind of what they can and cannot do is determined heavily by politics, and that changes on a pretty regular basis. Anesthesiology assistants are not really medical background providers. They have a master's in anesthesia. About half of the states in the country recognize them, and they must always work under supervision of an anesthesiologist. So there's no like independent practice for anesthesiology assistants.
Great.
So those are basically the main players of the periop space.
Yeah, no, I love that. I really appreciate you going through in detail, because I think, again, a lot of people who aren't already anesthesiologists or at least anesthesia residents may not know, and especially people going in for surgery may not realize all the different people involved in their care. So this has been fabulous. Do you want to just kind of summarize, Phil, kind of, you know, what we've covered and the key points?
Yeah. So to summarize, I hope that we all have an appreciation for anesthesiologists, and that we're acute care physicians, that we specialize in drug-induced comas, managing and manipulating physiology, and procedures related to airway management, vascular access, and pain management. And we are the most consistent physician present in the perioperative domain, which means that we're not only uniquely positioned to participate in all aspects of periop care, but that we can use this influence and the relationships that we build to make the OR more efficient and to make patient care safer. That's basically the summary. I wish I kind of had someone frame this for me when I was a medical student or a resident, but this is my understanding of what I do at this stage of my life.
I love it. And I really think both for people, you know, interested in anesthesia, but also for anyone who's going to have surgery in anesthesia, this is really, you know, a nice way to have an idea of what's going on and who's involved. Well, fabulous. Phil, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something fun you'd recommend the audience check out?
Yes, I do. And I'm also, you know, the pediatric anesthesiologist and also a father of two. I read a lot of children's books. So I don't know if anyone's ever recommended a children's book, but I'm going to recommend Llama Llama Little Lie. It's about a llama boy who's really excited and throws a ball in the house and breaks his mama's favorite photo. And then when Mama Llama comes in, baby llama lies and basically says, oh, a dinosaur came in and ate it, or a meteor came in and popped through and hit the picture, and all these things. And then he learns that even though it's hard sometimes and you make mistakes and you may lie, that the best thing to do is to tell the truth, and that usually people forgive you. So I read that to my son pretty often. It's one of his favorite books, Llama Llama Little Lie.
Awesome. Thanks, Phil. I've got a couple things. So first, just a reminder and a shout out about ACRAC in Spanish, which continues to post more episodes on Spotify. So if you're looking to listen to ACRAC in Spanish, there are going to be more and more of the episodes getting posted. Check that out. And also, my shout out is, and I just love this, one of the University of Pennsylvania CA1s has published her debut fiction novel, which just blows my mind. I mean, the fact that she was able to do this is so impressive. It's called Wedding Issues, and she published it under the pen name L. Evans. The book is a fun beach read about a law student named Olivia who becomes the maid of honor for two weddings competing for a bridal magazine cover. And then you throw in a scheming aunt, a forbidden crush, and lots of wedding sabotage, and all hell quickly breaks loose. Wedding Issues is now out, and it'll be available anywhere you get books, both online and at bookstores. So I just think how impressive that this anesthesia resident was able to do this. I can't wait to check it out myself, and I recommend you do as well. Awesome. All right. Well, Phil, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.